1:35 on Friday, March 30th, 2012. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Coghill is here, Vice Chair Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. I think the other two members are occupied somewhere else. I don't expect them, but we'll always be happy to welcome them if they show up. We have five bills on the listed agenda. Let me go through just a quick status update for the public who might be listening or watching. HB 6 was Representative Grunberg's bill about removal of a regent. Senator Coghill asked that it be held over. In the meantime, he's gotten an alleged legal opinion that has caused me to pause on that bill and think over its retroactivity. And so I'm going to mull that over the weekend. And HB 6 is in its last committee referral. I do expect it to leave the committee in plenty of time to pass, but it's an interesting issue, and I want to make sure we give it careful consideration. Likewise, SB 198 is Senator Wilkowski's bill. He is still in negotiations with the two parties over that bill, and so that is not going to be on the calendar today. If you're here for SB 198, it is not going to be on the calendar today, and we will give you plenty of notice before it's back up. That brings us to SB 138. Also one of Senator Wilkowski's bill, and the committee should have a backslash U uniform CS before it, and Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we adopt version backslash U as the working document before us.
Is there objection?
Only, Mr. Chairman, I don't have it yet. I'm sorry. Where? I thought I had everything on here. A U version?
U. Should be dated yesterday, 3/28/12. You've just been handed one.
All right, no objection.
Okay, you've got the CS, and so without objection, the CS backslash U is before. Senator Wilkowski, you or one of your staff want to tell us what's in the CS?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the last hearing we heard concerns from ACS, and they had some proposed amendments. We have taken their suggestions and incorporated them into CS, and staff member intern Thomas Presley come forward and just go through.
Mr. Presley, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I am Thomas Presley, intern to Senator Wilkowski. Thank you for the opportunity to present the changes to SB 138. The CS before you is version U, and the following changes incorporate all three of ACS's amendments offered in their testimony last hearing. The first change is in section 1 on page 2, lines 11 through 15. Subsection C was modified. A telecommunications carrier may not discontinue service as a result over disputed third-party charges. And the customer may submit dispute of those third-party charges orally or electronically to the ACS or telecommunications carrier. The second change is also in section 1 on page 2, lines 17 through 19. A new subsection was added. Subsection D now reads that a telecommunications carrier may recover from a person or billing agent reasonable costs incurred in implementing billing charges or otherwise complying with this section. You'll notice that in this section, person and billing agent are those defined as responsible for putting third-party charges on telephone bills. So the telecommunications carrier is not recovering costs from customers, but unpaid charges from third-party vendors that have been disputed. Lastly, on page 3, lines 28 through 30 in section 3, a new subsection D was added. That subsection now reads, telecommunications carriers have no duty to verify independently the accuracy of information received from a person or billing agent under this section. This new CS has been transmitted and received by ACS. I anticipate their approval as all three of their amendments have been included with few modifications. I'd also like to take this opportunity to present to the committee, to bring to the committee's attention that similar to Verizon last week, AT&T has also voluntarily pledged to discontinue billing for all third-party enhanced services that are non-telephone related as of August.
Excellent. Questions for the bill sponsor or his able staff on the CS? We do have Cindy Drinkwater, as before, here to answer questions. She's from the Department of Law Consumer Protection Unit. We have one person signed up to testify. That's Bob Lohr from the Alaska Center for Public Policy. Maybe we should turn to Mr. Lohr. If you're there, welcome to the committee.
Good
Bob Lohr? Not hearing him. Let's.
Sorry.
There we go.
Difficulty here. Technical incompetence on my part.
Quite okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd like to register the support of the Alaska Center for Public Policy for Senate Bill 138. I think it's important legislation. It's very timely, and it's important consumer protection. There's been testimony earlier that the practice of third-party billing is important to consumers because it brings costs down and it brings competitive choice to the customer. And I think in an ideal world, this would perhaps be the case. But my background as a former executive director of the Public Utilities Commission and former chief insurance regulator for the state of Alaska suggests to me that this is not an effectively competitive market. Two of the assumptions that economists make about competitive markets are that there's perfect information available, and secondly, that there are zero transactions costs. And I think these are both demonstrably not the case where the consumer is misled or flat out misrepresented with respect to the charges on the bill. Senator Egan mentioned in the previous hearing, even he has been a victim of this kind of thing. I think with reasonable diligence, people can still become victims of unauthorized charges in this area. So the requirements in this bill to be clear and to be concise in the billing practices and in the authorization for making the billings is extremely important legislation, and it should be on the books. There is clearly not perfect information here, especially the case when, upon identifying that unauthorized charges are occurring, there's considerable difficulty on the part of the consumer to remove those charges going forward or get an appropriate refund. Those should not be difficult exercises, but in fact they have been for many, many customers around the country. I would note that the practices of other than the local exchange companies with respect to these billings are an issue. For example, just today in the press, there's an indication that up to 10 million Visa and MasterCards may have been subject to confidential information theft, and it apparently did not occur from either of the providers whose security is quite good. Rather, it happened on the part of a third-party aggregator. Now, this is identity theft. This is confidential information theft. It's a bit different, but I think the same thing of things flowing downhill and the adequacy and the appropriateness of charges at the lower level are very illustrative here. I think the bill is a good one. I'm a little bit concerned about the amendments that are being proposed in the work draft because I think there's an element there of blame the victim. If a customer has a bill of $50 for local exchange service and $25 for charges that he or she doesn't recognize, and that customer submits a bill payment of $50, I think the intent is quite clear, even if there's not a written instruction on the bill as to how to allocate the charge. The customer knows that if you don't pay your bills, you can be cut off. But if you don't pay your bills that you don't recognize, you shouldn't be at risk for loss of service. And therefore, I would maintain the notion of consumer protection. I'm heartened to see that both Verizon and AT&T have come around to recognizing this is a genuine issue. However, I think the legislation is still vitally necessary because there are other players out there that need to be taught what the law is to avoid the risk of rogue operations. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Lohr, thank you. I appreciate your testimony, particularly given your background in the area of consumer protection via government regulation. Could you just, for the record, though, just make sure that we have you down, just tell us your name and affiliation.
Yes, Bob Lohr, L-O-H-R, Executive Director of the Alaska Center for Public Policy, and thank you for the clarification.
Absolutely, and we again, I don't see any questions, but thanks again for taking the time to testify. I have one question, and that's for the bill's sponsor or staff. We got a list of three proposed amendments from ACS. I tracked the first and third one. I didn't track where the middle one got inserted in the bill. If you could just remind me.
Yes, to the chair, that the second change recommended by ACS that should be in Section 1, page 2, lines 17 through 19, that a telecommunications carrier may recover from a person or billing agent reasonable costs incurred in implementing billing charges.
Now, that looks like that the looks first like proposed change of ACS.
On their list, what is the second one?
The second one is that it's eight lines, and it has the word non-discontinuance,
which I just object to
on English grounds, but otherwise.
Right. So that change is reflected in a modification of a section, not a new subsection. So that is in Section 1, page 2, lines 11 through 15.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know,
may not continue. Much better drafting. Very good. Well, I appreciate that. I think it's admirable that you were able to work in all three suggestions from ACS, one of the leading telecommunications companies in the state. I don't see them online, but having adopted all their recommendations, I don't see what else it is they could ask for. So I appreciate that. Further discussion.
Yeah, just we've worked very hard with all the parties, everyone concerned, Mr. Chairman, the third-party carriers, the telephone companies, and I think it's a better bill. And if you're ready for a motion,
Mr. Chairman,
I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill Number 138 /U out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none of the bills move, we'll take a brief at ease to do the paperwork. Let's go back on the record, and we will turn now to HB, not 6, but 56, and we have a prime sponsor of the bill with us, Representative Grunberg. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for scheduling the bill. It's a relatively short bill. It simply adds arson in the first degree and arson in the second degree, the conspiracy. And we have several witnesses here. It should be very brief. I'd like my legislative assistant, Miles Brooks, to present the bill.
Mr. Brooks, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Miles Brooks, and I am a Representative Grunberg. House Bill 56 adds first and second degree to the crime of conspiracy list, which will provide a strong deterrent to committing arson and closing a current loophole in law. HB 56 was drafted after it became a concern in a hearing last session that arson in the first and second degree weren't in the list of serious felonies that were afforded or included in the Alaska conspiracy statute. Because of this, arsonists may only be charged if the crime is actually committed or attempted. And as many are aware, there also many times arson is a crime that's committed or at least planned by two or more people. So this is an act of concern. Just a reminder that this bill only adds first and second degree arson to the crime of conspiracy list. Arson in the first degree is damaging a property by fire explosion and recklessly placing another person in danger, including emergency personnel. And arson two is knowingly damaging a building by fire explosion. Arson one, Class A felony. Arson two, Class B felony. The conspiracy to commit arson 1 would be a B felony. Conspiracy to commit arson 2 would be a C felony. So in conclusion, I feel that HB 56 will fix some of these loopholes where two or more people plan an arson, and oftentimes once arson is committed, it's very hard to prove as much as the evidence is damaged in the fire itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would only add that for a conspiracy, there has to be a criminal agreement and one act towards the agreement. It's much less of an actus reus that's required than in an attempt. An attempt requires a substantial step towards the final crime. And usually, if you're going to make that in an arson, it would be something like you torched the building and then the wind blew the fire out or something. And it's arson because the evidence is destroyed is very hard to prove.
We're always happy to have a refresher in the criminal law and basics, and so you may have Ms. Carpentini come up and walk us through attempt versus conspiracy.
I even have my Perkins if you guys need it.
Thank you. Just for clarity's sake, the version I have of the bill is M/M.
That is correct, sir.
That should be the version that came to us. Ms. Carpentini, welcome to the committee.
I need my sidekick. My name is Annie Carpentini, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And to tell you the truth, I'm always concerned when I have to explain the difference between attempt and conspiracy. But I think Representative Gruenberg did a very good job. Conspiracy requires an agreement among at least two people with the specific intent to commit a crime and plus an act in furtherance of that agreement.
One act.
Yes, and it could be going out and buying
a gas can.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And that would be adequate for the elements of conspiracy.
And as I recall, you can't have an attempted conspiracy. Is that right?
Because yes, I think you're right.
Right. I think that's the little nuance that pops into my head from years ago. Questions for Ms. Carpentini. Why is it that Alaska requires us to specifically list the crimes that can be subject to a conspiracy charge?
Mr. Chairman, that's an interesting question. When the Criminal Code was revised in 1978, actually the decision was made not to have a conspiracy provision in the substantive criminal law for the state. And I think in the early 80s, the legislature changed their collective minds, but they wanted to make it very limited to certain very serious crimes and those that would be subject to more likely happen by agreement among people. So that's why they limited to serious. I mean, this definition of serious felony offense is pretty limited, considering all the crimes we have in our laws.
Sure. I mean, you can't have a conspiracy to commit theft, for example, as I'm glancing at this. Is that right?
That's correct. Right. And in fact, all of these serious felony offenses are a B felony is the lowest level. And this bill would add a Class A felony and a Class B felony.
A B felony. Sure. Further questions for the Department of Law? Senator Coghill.
Just on proving a conspiracy, help me understand the levels that you have to go through over against a, say, an intent to create a arson over against conspiracy. What do you have to prove? It seems to me like this could be a very high level, proving a conspiracy of two more people to act. So I'm just kind of curious how that would look in the process.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coghill, well, you would have evidence that two or more people conspired or got together and agreed that a certain target crime would be committed, and they both intended that target, say, well, let's use this example, say that they wanted to burn down a building and an attempt to get insurance money to make a claim for insurance. So they got together and they went out and purchased incendiary materials and those acts together, proof that they intended the crime, you have to prove what crime they intended, and that somebody, one, not all of them, but at least one person, did an act in furtherance of the conspiracy, that purchasing or an attempt of a fire. You go buy a can of gas, I guess that would be the best example. An attempt would be if a person decided he or she wanted to burn down their house because they wanted to get insurance recompense for that house. They went out and bought can of gas and spread it around the outside of their house and lit a match, and then for some reason the fire didn't catch and it didn't destroy the house. That would be the difference. But you would still an attempt still requires specific intent, proof of specific intent.
And I don't understand why the conspiracy issue, but I understand how that would work better now. This would be probably in addition to other charges, though, I take it?
Through the chair, it depends. The law does allow a person to be convicted, which is unusual in these preparatory offenses. Most like attempt, you can't be convicted of attempt and the target crime.
Right.
But you can actually be convicted of conspiracy and the completed crime, which is the only one I'm aware of in our law that allows that conviction for both offenses. And I think that the rationale behind the conspiracy law is that once people agree to commit a crime, it's more likely that it will actually happen than if one person just thinks about it and doesn't get together with other people to talk about it and agree.
So if somebody was a suspected arsonist, Mr. Chairman, an investigation then would probably ensue to find a conspiracy. If they suspected somebody, they would look for those kind of conspiratorial actions then, I take it?
Yes. It's difficult to, I'm through the chair, these crimes are very difficult to prove, and they are few and far between in our prosecutions.
Just want to know, because I have a house, in case anybody's out there burning houses down, I want to know how to watch for those things. Anyway, that helps me understand it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Further questions for the Department of Law? I don't see any. Thank you so much for being here. We do have Dan Jaeger testify. Or it might be Jaeger. I'm about to find out. Mr. Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record. Tell us who you are and who you're affiliated with, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Dan Jaeger. I live here in Juneau. I am the Fire Marshal for Capital City Fire and Rescue, and I'm also a member of the Alaska Association of Fire and Arson Investigators. I've been actively investigating fires for the last 10 years. I've investigated fires that have occurred in Juneau, Fairbanks, North Pole area, Valdez, and for the State Fire Marshal's Office out of the Anchorage main office. The arson crime itself is very difficult to investigate, and catching the suspect directly responsible for lighting the fire is even harder. The reason for speaking today is for support of HB 56. As you may have read in a recent Juneau Empire article, arson is a problem here in Juneau as well as around the state. In 2011, there were over 30 fires classified as arson or suspicious in nature here in Juneau. The property destroyed by these fires included vehicles, structures, open fields, and school parks. We had three cases in which suspects were identified and are in some part of the legal system itself. One is an adult male who set fire to our aerial ladder truck with two of our firemen that were inside the cab. We had two juveniles, ages 7 and 12, who lit separate fires inside of the local Fred Meyer and Walmart stores in December. It is in my experience that arson cases are not usually planned or carried out by just one individual. Often more than one person is involved in planning the crime and then executing it. As it is now, arsonists may be only charged with crime if arson is completed or if it is attempted, which requires that a substantial step towards arson occurs. Without this, both people cannot be charged with separate crime of conspiracy if two or more people are involved in the act. The passing of this bill will provide stronger punishment whether or not the conspirators complete the arson. There are open and active cases in Juneau that this bill could have been beneficial in helping close and hold those responsible accountable for their actions.
Mr. Jaeger, thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate your public service and taking the time to come in and give us your views. It's we don't have eyes and ears out in the community. You're our eyes and ears, and I appreciate you bringing these cases to our attention. They sound very serious.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Further questions? We will hold this bill over. It seems like a great bill. We'll just hold it over, mull it over one session as we normally do. And Representative Grunberg, closing remarks? If you can get a little closer to the mic, please.
This is Max Grunberg. You asked about the history of the conspiracy statute. When I served in the 1980s, this originally, and most of us who who were serving then went to, had gone to law school, were taught that conspiracy was something that you had to be very careful about. But subsequently, criminals, I think, got more sophisticated, and we just learned in the real world that conspiracy might be important for certain crimes. And it took about 10 years in this state legislature, and I was there for the first part of it. And first was homicides and very serious crimes against the person, and ultimately it got into some things like some drug offenses and things like this. I don't know why arson wasn't included. And 2 years ago, we were having a hearing in House Judiciary, and we dragged out this statute, and we saw arson wasn't included, and we all sat around and said, well, this is something we ought to look at. And so this bill has made its way through, and there's the sex trafficking bill, the governor's sex trafficking bill, that it will add sex trafficking to conspiracy also, and I think you guys may have had that. But those are the two that I'm aware of that deal with the crime of conspiracy, and they're both very serious crimes, and they're often are conspiracies. And I hope that would answer your question.
A very good answer, and thank you for that. Let me just check while we still have the bill before us if there's anyone else in the room who wants to testify on HB 56. Anyone else online? We'll go ahead and close public testimony then on HB 56. And thank you so much again, Representative Grunberg. We'll set the bill aside. That brings us to the last bill we expect to take up today, and that's SB 224, a bill that comes to us from the Labor and Commerce Committee. I see a representative of that committee coming forward. Mr. Owen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. Put yourself on the record. Tell us your, give us the overview of this bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen. I'm staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, sponsor of this legislation. It has come to our attention that there is something that we believe is an inequity in labor negotiations with the state. And currently, it's our understanding that representatives of collective bargaining units, when they advise or represent their members, that their communications are not held confidential. So in proceedings that evolve from disciplinary actions, it turns out that one side, that is to say management, can subpoena those communications and can have access to any advice or any strategy discussions that the two may have. The same is not true of the member at that time. I think we'll hear testimony later today that I believe indicates that of the, if I remember correctly, the testimony before our committee, that some seven people who do this for the administration, of those, only one is not an attorney. So those attorneys, of course, any communication they have will be confidential, and the union member could not have access to those. On the other hand, the management folks do have access to those very same kinds of communications with union representatives, unless, of course, those union representatives happen to be attorneys. As it turns out, most of them are not, and I think you'll hear more about that later on this afternoon. But in any event, we introduced the bill to try and correct this inequity, and with that, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
Questions for the bill sponsor, Senator Wilikowski.
Would this apply to all union members in the state or public employee union members?
Mr. Chairman, it seems clear to me that it would apply to all, but I'm not certain. I honestly, to be perfectly clear, we were thinking about union representatives of people who work for the state. Is that?
Just for the record, Mr. Chairman, I just want to declare, I think everyone knows I work for a labor union in the state, and just want to put that on the record.
But you're an attorney.
I'm an attorney. It wouldn't apply to me.
Any response?
No, Mr. Chairman.
We have many people signed up to testify. We have John Patasten signed up. We have from the Department of Law. We have Kate Sheehan from the Division of Personal and Labor Relations. Nancy Meads here to answer questions from the court system. Doug Mertz is here to testify on behalf of himself. Steven Sorensen, Jake Metcalf, both from PSCA. Why don't we turn to the Department of Law, Mr. Patasten, have him come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Hi.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah.
And you can tell us why this bill isn't fair.
Okay. Well, I'll testify first and then please ask a lot of questions because
sure.
This may be the only opportunity you get to ask from the employer side on this. Again, my name is John Patasson. I, with the Department of Law, I represent the Department of Personnel and Labor Relations. Typically, we don't discuss ongoing cases before the legislature. There is an ongoing case that deals with this specific issue, but I'm going to try to speak in generalities today. But we'd be remiss if we stayed on the sidelines in this one, given the testimony so far in other committees. So I'd like to do three things today for your benefit. First, I'd like to set the table for how these lawsuits get initiated and why it is the state sees the need to obtain certain communications between unions and their members. Second, I'd like to put to rest some of the misconceptions that have been made about our conduct in these cases. And third, just like to note that the privileges as drafted appear rather complicated at this time, and I'll go through some of the issues that you should be looking at as you decide whether this is a good idea or not. So I'll start with a brief overview of the life of how these claims come to pass and how they make their way into superior courts. The state of Alaska is a large employer. Most people who are in state service find it a privilege to be working for the state, and they act accordingly while they're on the job. Or it's a fact of life that some employees don't belong in state service, and for all sorts of reasons, they have to be terminated from their employment, sometimes for egregious conduct. So when we're faced with a termination decision as an employer, it's important for this committee to understand what happens next. We're primarily a unionized workforce here in the state of Alaska, and it's really important to understand that by law, the employer and the union, when there's a termination decision made by the employer, they have to enter into the grievance process to see whether the state needs to rethink its decision to terminate the employee. The union has a very important role during these grievance procedures. They represent the member while they're trying to conciliate with the employer. However, at the same time, they represent the entire collective bargaining unit as a whole. So they've got not necessarily dual representation, but there's a lot going on with what they're trying to decide is the best course. During these grievance processes, the union comes to the employer twice, most times three times, to try to explain why the state should look at its decision again and decide, well, should we reinstate this person? Or,
and let me just ask a question about that before we get too, you know, it's probably easier to ask questions as we go along.
Yeah, go ahead.
The from do these only come up in terminations? That's what I'm trying to say. Can it be something less than a termination that begins a grievance process that could lead to a request for discovery?
Well, a request for discovery, no, because that's when we talk about civil court decisions. With more minor grievances, suspensions, things like that, there wouldn't really be a need to ask for information at that point. And Kate Sheehan can explain that far better. We're not very involved at that level where these kind of more minor grievances are going on.
Sure. So there's lots of different, you know, adverse actions against an employee that may not rise to the level of a termination.
Right.
What cases go to court? Is it more than terminations, or do other cases also go to court? Demotions, suspensions?
What Department of Law primarily handles is only when there's a termination, at least from the employment section.
95% plus, this is going to apply to termination.
Right.
The appeal of termination decisions.
Not the appeal of a termination decision per se, because most decisions of the employer to terminate a worker never gets submitted to superior court. And that is because as part of this process that I was talking about, this grievance process, at the end of the line for that is binding arbitration on the state. If the employee's union decides this is important enough for us to take this grievance all the way to binding arbitration against the state if the state doesn't concede enough during the grievance process.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Senator Cockhill.
Just on that, you said at the end, and so there's a grievance process at the front, mm-hmm. binding arbitration at the end. Is that process agreed to contractually?
Yes. This is all part of the collective bargaining agreement, and by law under PURA, whenever a state employee bargaining union is formed, the state has to do this. We have to allow for binding arbitration at the end of any grievance process.
So I know we're going to be talking about the more serious ends, but I want to know kind of the context. So at this point, we talk about lawyers and non-lawyers, but right. the reality is it looks like they've already bargained out what the process is going to be.
Right.
I didn't see that yet, and right. so I'm – I read a little bit of the court case, but I want to know the process.
Yeah, and to follow up on this, while this is going on through up to the grievance process through binding arbitration, Department of Law isn't really representing. I mean, this is what's going on between the actual employer and this employee and their union. Department of Law doesn't get involved until that relationship and that realm ends and we get sued.
So the employer at this point, at what level in employment are we talking about? The top level of administration, immediate supervisor, department level?
You know, Kate Sheehan can answer this better. There's a lot of and it really depends on which step of the grievance you're in. On the lower steps, you deal with somebody who's essentially a business agent if you were going to do their corollary at the union. And then as the steps progress, you get up into higher and higher management, usually a DOPLR, but Kate could definitely speak to that better than I could. But again, an important point at this stage is this is a conciliatory a conduct between the employer and the employee. It's the non-legal just them talking back and forth to decide, look, can we come to some sort of agreement on this? And then at the end, if they can't, the union has a very difficult decision to make. Do we take this case to binding arbitration? It's expensive. Takes a lot of time. But at the end of the day, in some of these cases, the union decides, maybe for the benefit of the entire collective bargaining union, this is not a case that we feel is going to go to arbitration. There could be a number of reasons why the union decides that. I can't speak for why a union decides that.
This is where I'm going to have to learn a little bit. The binding arbitration, is that like an administrative law hearing? Or how do you see that? How does that fit into the realm of adjudication?
Well, binding arbitration, the way it works is that both sides will strike names and come to an agreement who the arbitrator is going to be. Okay. And then you put on evidence in front of this arbitrator. The union has their side, the employer does. Whatever that arbitrator decides is binding on both parties, and it's very hard to overturn those decisions. And the state loses these decisions. There are employees that perhaps the state feels shouldn't be employed, but an arbitrator decided, nope, you have to reinstate this person. Now, that's very different from what we're talking about in this bill and in this what's before you now, because during all of that, during this grievance process, during arbitration, that's all refereed by the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. It's all a conduct under the Public Employee Rights Act. Go ahead.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. So just so we're clear here, though, this would apply to all unions in the state?
Yes, it seems to be.
And it would apply to all unions that are either state employee unions or under the NLR, National Labor Relations Act, right?
Seems to.
Okay, just
Teamsters.
Everyone.
Right, IBW, pipe fitters.
Right.
Right. So what I want to make clear here is that during all of these processes that I've just got done explaining, the Alaska Labor Relations Agency is refereeing that, and if the state were to try to obtain documents during that proceeding while there's an ongoing grievance or if there's binding arbitration, an arbitrator and Alaska Labor Relations Agency could step in and say, you are not to obtain those documents under PURA or under it's an unfair labor practice. They could make that ruling. That's not what this bill is intended to change. That's always been the ground rules during those processes. What happens sometimes when the union decides we're not taking this particular case to arbitration for whatever reason, the individual and the union no longer have a relationship. That individual has the right to bring the employer to court and say, you got it wrong, the union got it wrong, everybody's wrong, I need to be reinstated or something has to happen, this was unfair. That is what this bill, or at least what I see this bill does, is it creates a privilege for everything that happened in that other realm. And now we're here in Superior Court, and that's what I think that this bill takes aim at.
Senator Likowski has a question.
I think that's inaccurate. I think that's seriously inaccurate. First of all, not all these cases are governed by the ALRA. A lot of the cases are governed by the National Labor Relations Act. That's number one. But number two, the state has the ability to go ahead and when an employee and his representative, who he thinks or she thinks they're having confidential communications, the state is going in and requesting that the confidential documents, the confidential information that the employee shared with his business rep. It's not necessarily in the unfair labor practice realm. It can be any realm at all. And I think that's what the amicus brief is specifically addressing. It's a case where the state subpoenaed information from the employee to get confidential communications between the employee and his business rep.
Certainly, but through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we're in civil litigation at this point. There is no longer an active grievance going on. There is no longer anything going on as far as the relationship between the member and the union. What the member has done is he's put all of this at issue by filing a breach of contract claim against the state and has said, you know, you have treated me unfairly, not only in terminating me, but what happened during that grievance process.
And maybe we can get a perspective from someone else. Can you give me an example of why a court case is more advantageous to an employee rather than an arbitration process?
I have no idea why that would be more, because the collective bargaining process and that binding arbitration is fair. The union itself gets to pick who the arbitrator is. Mm-hmm. I don't do a lot of this work. I do it on these other cases, mm-hmm. but. You know, that is binding. It is less expensive than filing a Superior Court case. Mm-hmm. I would leave that to other people to explain, though.
Okay. Senator Coghill.
So, at this point, it looks like there was a hiring grievance, and so this was with a state and employee and the union privilege, so I understand it. Let's just say I was a private company and I had the same circumstance. Have we already tested this in law previously? Has there been either public or private employee who's gone through a scenario like this that said that privilege has, it sounded to me like it was already contractual, the issue on arbitration. So I'm in my mind, I'm trying to figure out, was that had to be discussed somewhere along the line previously or maybe this is our first test on this. I don't know.
It's a fair question. I think when you're talking about those processes that are going on as part of the collective bargaining agreement below, I think there is an inherent need to allow for the member to communicate with the union, no question, while that process is ongoing. However, once that process ends and the union member decides, I don't like the result, I'm going to put this entire thing and other matters at issue in a Superior Court case, no court has allowed the crossover, that jump into Superior Court, to say, well, there's definitely a privilege here under common law or anything less than a statute. Go ahead.
Senator Wilikowski.
Does the state, if I'm hearing you correctly, the state agrees that in the context of the grievance process and arbitration process, the communications between the employee and his business representative, union representative, are privileged and confidential?
I wouldn't say there's a privilege. I would that word isn't used in any collective bargaining agreements that I'm aware of, but it's trying to speak for what ALRA would say if we tried to obtain documents during those processes.
What would ALRA say?
ALRA would probably call it a confidence. I don't think it elevates to a privilege, though.
Senator Coghill.
So just this is a general understanding I have that, you know, you could have an employer, even if a private employer, who employs both the business agent and the employee, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there should be a strategy element between the union members on the collective bargaining positions, making sure the contractual obligations are fulfilled and that sort of thing. But there's also, isn't there a duty to the employer that they've agreed to when they took employment that should be open to the employer?
Again, that would be specific to a collective bargaining agreement, but I will say that there is a general duty to keep workplaces safe. There are moments where the union probably has a duty to tell the employer, this is going on, we need to address this. There is that duty, I believe.
So does it come, Mr. Chairman, does it come down to the privileged information or the confidential information, however you want to put it, between, say, a bargaining unit and protecting the rights of their bargaining contract over against the rights of the employer to, say, do a the right job if they're, let's say, they're a contractor, the right kind of applications if somebody is not fulfilling a license, for example, or something like that? That's an employer's interest. If there was conversations going on about that between, say, a business agent and an employee, wouldn't an employer have a right to know that?
Well, and that's through the chair, Senator Coghill. That's one of several, I believe, conversations that has to be had about what this privilege does and what it would create in a lot of different scenarios. So.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And just from a public policy perspective, and I'll just tell you the way I've seen it work. The unions, most unions don't have attorneys. Many don't have attorneys. And so they have business representative or business agents that represent the employees acting essentially as attorneys. It's perfectly allowable. They're representing them. They are going ahead and
they're giving advice?
Giving advice. Mm-hmm. And they're preparing documents. They're filing documents. They're filing briefs. They're giving opening arguments, closing arguments. They are fully advising the employee. And so in that case, since they are essentially acting that way, this is NLRA allows this, ALRA allows this, what's the possible public policy reason for saying we're going to allow, if that person happens to be an attorney, we're going to allow that conversation to be privileged, but if that person happens to be a non-attorney, we're not going to allow that to be privileged?
Well, first of all, you've, through the chair, you've said a number of times they essentially act as attorneys, but I think that, respectfully, I think it's a little bit of an oversimplification because that business agent not only represents that individual during the grievance process, but they are representing the collective as a whole.
So is the attorney.
No, an attorney represents a client.
No, the attorney represents the union. And, I mean, that's the essence of the relationship. The grievance that goes forward essentially is the union grievance going forward. But the union attorney in that case represents the employee. It's the same. I mean, it's exactly the same. There's no difference at all whether it's a union attorney or whether it's a business representative who's not an attorney.
But at the end of the day, it is at the end of the day, the attorney represents not only the individual's interest but the union's collective bargaining interest as a whole.
So does the business representative.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe just for my understanding, and you may be able to answer this, would a union, say like a business agent who would be acting in that situation, would they be getting legal counsel from the union at that point?
Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Mr. Patasson, we're here in part, I think, because of what some folks viewed as abusive discovery practices, reaching out and trying to get the conversations that took place between a union rep and a employee during the grievance process. And as much as I don't want to drag this case into it, it seems inevitable because I have to ground this in some kind of specifics. In the specific case, you were trying to find out whether this employee had exhausted his administrative remedies. Is that right?
Just factually, yes.
That's factually correct.
One of many, but yeah.
Right. Okay. I guess I don't have any other questions. I just want to make sure I understood the facts. Yeah,
Senator Coghill. Did the state in fact subpoena? Is that what the issue
right.
they
right.
actually did? And so why? What was the issue that had to be resolved under that?
Well, it's a number of issues, and I can just say what we spoke to in our oral argument in our briefing and before the Supreme Court. The oral argument is that First of all, with respect to exhaustion, in most instances, as you may or may not know, there are 3 to 4 steps in a grievance process, and the last process is, in fact, internal. And that means that the union member has to communicate with his union internally to say, I disagree with the business agent's decision. I want this to go to a full board, to decide whether to take my case to binding arbitration.
So let me get that right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
From the initial grievance to a this is before arbitration?
Yeah, this is when the union at step 3 decides we're not taking this to arbitration. The employee has one final step that they have to complete, and that is to go to, at least in this collective bargaining agreement, they have to take one more step and say, I want an entire committee of people to review this at the union. And if you don't do that step, if you don't do it, your case in superior court gets dismissed in all likelihood because you have not exhausted every opportunity for the employer to decide, did we treat this individual fairly or did we not? It's essential that they follow that fourth step.
Go ahead. So would you be able to then to subpoena, say, what the board said if you got that far?
That's before the court. Whether I'm allowed to ask.
That's exactly what they're doing now?
That's in part what they're doing. And I don't want to oversimplify our argument. I mean, we think that these records are incredibly helpful in proving that we treated the employee fairly in the breach of contract claim that they are bringing against the employer in this case as well. We think there's opportunity for those documents to have bias in them. We believe that there's opportunity for those documents to show prior inconsistent statements. A full panoply of issues that could come before the trier of fact, which is a jury in this case, deciding whether the employer treated
Mr. Chairman.
Just 1 second. I'm getting signals from the back of the room. Is that because you can't hear or because you have something you want to say at some point? Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. It's just confusing. That's okay. I want to make sure you can hear. I just want to make sure you can hear. Yeah. Fair enough. Ms. Podesta, you probably have about 5 more minutes where we will have to move to other witnesses. Sometimes I'm too pragmatic, but in my view, maybe we need a statute that says you can send a form over to the union and they have to check the box. Did this guy exhaust all his, remedies? And they would have to send back the box, and the box would be admissible. I don't know, but it just seems like, I have a lot of sympathy for this idea that you're reaching into what I would feel was a privileged communication and getting the contents of that in a fluid situation about my job. It feels invasive. It just does.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cockill.
Help me if I understand the characterization right, and maybe the chairman can help me. This looks to me like is the subpoena saying we want to go into your huddle to find out your strategy, or do we want to know what the action affecting the employer is? And that's, to me, one of them should be privileged, or at least their ability to have a kind of a scrum, if you will, to decide how they're going to manage it over against what is the value to know the employer information is about. For example, is it going to be hurtful to the company? Is it going to cost them money? Is it going to somehow hurt the reputation? To me, that would be valuable information to know, under that scenario. Anyway, I'm just, in my mind, trying to figure out where one is strategy and where one is going to affect the company to a big degree. Just
Go ahead and answer that question, and then one thing at a time. Yeah.
And again, these are matters of policy before the legislature at this time, but the privileges you've just described it is not what this bill does. As we just talked about the exhaustion issue, that is a communication in all likelihood between the member and the union itself. This bill would not allow us to probe for that, even though the member has put it squarely at issue. In the little bit of time I have, I just want to note about the bill particulars itself. Maybe I just walk down. And then, again, if there are questions after this or anything, always feel free to call the department.
It's a complicated bill. We'll probably have you back again.
Okay. Under Section 2A1, this is page 2, lines 5 and 6, it talks about anything gets privileged if there's anticipated disciplinary proceedings. And what I'm doing is I think you ought to think or just try to understand if there's going to be problems with this down the road for courts that'll have to decide. Anticipated discovery proceedings is what's going to trigger the privilege. again, in the workplace, there's a lot of times when an employee has an unfounded belief that there's a disciplinary proceeding on the way. Whose belief is it? How's that going to work for judges trying to figure that out, or even parties? Under B2, the union can disclose if there's an ability to prevent crime if they disclose the privilege. And that to me seems to be the only time that the union has the opportunity to disclose. And it sounds like there's been some reading of the AFL-CIO brief in this case. My reading of that brief is that they would disagree with this privilege, where it's only the member holding the privilege. The union, in the AFL-CIO's brief, wants the ability to be able to waive it if it's for the benefit of the membership, of the entire membership. Your bill does not do that. Under Section 2B3, this in-camera provision, I think what you're trying to do is to allow us to prove that our needs outweigh their needs in confidentiality. I'm not sure. It may require some testimony of the drafter what their intention is there. And Section 2B4 waives, an employee can waive this privilege in writing. Well, I would submit that employees can waive a privilege at any time if they discuss it with anybody, and or it comes up in discovery. It's not that it's the only way I'm ever going to waive this privilege is if I put it in writing. That's problematic. Under D2A, forums already protected. There's this list of forums where this would apply to, and I would just submit that the only forum that's really at issue, because that confidence is already kept in most of those, is the judicial forum and the subsequent litigation that's brought by the member against the employer. I echo Senator French's statement that this is a complicated issue. The issues are before the Supreme Court now. So.
Senator Lukowski.
Yeah, and I think this really gets boiled down looking at page 1, line 14 is where it starts. And I actually think it's very simple, though. What it says is an individual may not be compelled in a proceeding to disclose information the individual acquired from an employee while the individual represented the employee on behalf of an organization if the information was, one, in confidence, and two, in connection with the providing advocacy services. I can't even envision any scenario where the state would have or any employer would have any policy reason to delve into the confidential information of an advocate that was acquired confidentially and in connection with providing advocacy services. I mean, what is the possible public policy rationale for allowing that?
The public policy rationale is that this case and the union has decided not to take the case to arbitration. It's before a jury. The jury has to make decisions whether or not what happened was fair. Advocacy services seems to be a broad umbrella, and there are facts latent in that relationship that are necessary to get to the bottom of in order to get to the correct disposition of a case. That's policy number one. Policy number two is that there are affirmative defenses in these cases, and you know there are certain conversations that happen between the union and the union member that are central to affirmative defenses, including exhaustion. So. This is more about what's happening at the civil court level, because all of these privileges, confidences, are intact while that process is ongoing.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the exhaustion issue, and it just seems like there's easier ways to get there. Senator Cockey,
I just wanted to hear that again. So if you go to an arbitration, the conversations between the union member and the union representation is not on the table, so to speak. It's just between the member and the union.
Well, under PURA, there's two bodies that would probably take issue with it. One, the actual arbitrator. The union could petition the arbitrator to tell the state essentially to not do that, and the arbitrator would probably tell them no. The other is to file an actual unfair labor practices claim against the state, and that would go to the Alaska Labor Relations Agency.
So under all of what we understand as the arbitration agreements and tests up to binding arbitration, not taken into this court, has there been a problem on this type of conversation of what was now called privileged conversation?
Not to my knowledge. It's only subsequent to that when the union member brings the case to a superior court essentially disagreeing with what happened below and puts at issue. I hope that answers your question.
Let's turn to Mr. Mertz.
Thank you.
Hear from the other side. Thanks, Mr. Potasnik. I appreciate it. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Douglas Mertz. I was an assistant attorney general for many years, and now I am in private practice here in Juneau. This whole issue came to me because of a client who was unjustly terminated by the state. And he went through, because he's required to under state law, went through the administrative process exhausting his administrative remedies. Now, the law also says that when you do that, you have to do it through the union.
Mr. Chairman, the question I heard was he did not exhaust, so help me understand.
It's one of the allegations that the state has made in this case, that
he didn't completely exhaust his
administrative remedies. And I want to say something about that in just a second, if I could. But first, the law says that you have to use your union advocate and cannot, may not use an attorney as your advocate during that administrative process. That includes the arbitration. Perhaps that was a good policy, perhaps it isn't, but in any case, it is what the law says. But well, then the problem...
Can I just ask, why is that? I mean, that seems like a funny rule. Why is it that you cannot use an attorney during a union grievance process?
A number of people have asked about that, asked whether it's even constitutional to prohibit you from using your own attorney.
Right.
And I don't think there is any answer except that at some point in the collective bargaining agreement, both the state and the unions, and multiple unions, decided that it was in the interest of all of them to make it an in-house thing and freeze out private attorneys.
Keep the cost down or something. Senator Coghill.
So two things. I understand then it is contractual, but what I asked the senator earlier, would a union representative generally get legal counsel along the way, though?
No. That is my experience, that they don't, unless there is some unique legal question. But as a routine matter, they don't. Now, most of these people, these lay advocates, are pretty experienced at what they do and pretty good at what they do, though they are not lawyers. So the lawyers don't come into it at all, although the individual can hire a private attorney to advise him on the side, and that attorney can attempt to advise the lay advocate with the union, but there comes the problem. In this case, after we finally filed suit, a subpoena came from the state saying, give us all union records related to this person. No bars hold at all of them, including all communications between his private attorney and the union representative.
Senator Coghill.
So I'm just trying to think of how the fair play might work. Could the union then have subpoenaed the employer for all records concerning conversations to that employee?
We indeed tried that, and their answer was no, it's a one-way street. There's another privilege that applies to state officials working through a case, and therefore it can only work in one direction. The state, according to the state, can get all the union materials, but the union and the private attorney, once it gets into litigation, can't get any information, any correspondence, anything from the other side.
So, but if I was Joe's contracting service, had a bunch of union employees, and we ended up in the situation, that privilege would not extend to the other employer?
To the other employer?
If I was outside of the state issue, right. if I was a contractor, I wanted to know what happened to my employee with the union, and I sued for that. Right. Would they be able then, in turn, be able to sue me for records showing my discovery process on what I thought about that employee, records I'd called, the people I'd called, things like that? So I'm taking it out of the state.
If you were a private employer, they probably could do it, except to the extent that you had consulted an attorney.
So it's now, the attorney problem. It's really... That's the issue then.
Attorney-client communications are highly protected. They're highly privileged.
Right. Once you get an attorney in there.
That's not true with the union rep then.
The union rep, right, right. When the union rep talks to the, yeah, that's the issue, exactly.
Not in this state. Yeah. Now, what are these materials that the state tried to get? It would include any discussions of tactics, any discussions of what we might be willing to settle for, what's our bottom line, what should we ask for, all those tactical decisions. It would include discussions of assessment of the case. It would include basically everything that normally in litigation would be considered highly confidential. It would even include the lay advocate's legal research files. The sort of things that there would be no question in civil litigation involving an attorney you could never get from the other side.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator.
Do I understand that correctly? If I had a suit and somebody was talking with their other lawyer, that information is behind a veil.
Anytime you talk to a lawyer, there's a very strong privilege.
Okay, but if there was an action that affected me personally, that would be open for discovery, but not the conversation?
Mr. Mertz, do you want to answer that?
I think I know what you're getting at. If the attorney actually witnessed something himself, what we call a percipient witness, that was relevant to the case, you could always ask the person about that. And in this case, in our case, Mr. Patasson says he needed to get the information that the lay advocate from the union held about exhaustion of administrative remedies. If it were an attorney involved, there might be an ability to define a certain class of data, of information, that would not invade the attorney's thought processes, the private communications.
Right. It'd be some kind of ministerial act. There should be a way to solve the problem, which is, I mean, it sounds like the last union act is internal, and so it's hard for an outsider to know whether all of the remedies have been exhausted. That's a common...
And in our case, right. We actually provided that information. They asked us for it in written discovery, written questions, and in the deposition, the live interview under oath with the client, and he fully testified as to all those materials. And if there was something else like that, that the state really needed to make its case, then I think the existing precedents interpreting the attorney-client privilege would allow the other side to get to those materials. It's the core confidential things about tactics, about settlement possibility, about the thought processes of the attorney.
I mean, spin this out for me. I mean, just so you have a good example, it's possible that in the last step, the union says to the employee, "No, you got a crummy case. We're not gonna go to arbitration. This is a stinker from our perspective."
Happens all the time.
Right, and so the employee goes, "Fine, I'm going to court." Employee goes to court, and then the state says, "Okay, I want to have that statement from the union telling the employee it's a stinker, so I can tell the judge and I can tell the jury." Look, the union thought it was a stinker. Mm-hmm. See, right here, this is the guy's own union telling him to knock it off.
Indeed, if he could get the records that show that, he could also call the union advocate as a witness against his own client.
What'd you think of his case? I told him it was a stinker.
Yeah. And I told him this reason, that reason, and that reason.
Yeah.
So what comes before a court is kind of the verbal he said, she said, unless there was some action outside of the arbitration, right? That's what I'm trying to think.
Well, no, I mean, I think I understand the question. What comes before the court should be all the things that happened in the workplace that made the employee a good or bad employee.
Yeah, okay, that's what I'm thinking.
Right, right. All those, you know, he was late, he was tardy, he didn't show up on time, he was doing computer games, or whatever it is. Okay, that's fine.
Or there was had prejudicial action by the employer.
You know,
right.
Whatever. But then do you reach in and say, okay, but I also want to know what you and your union talked about as you were trying to settle this case in arbitration. That's what I really want to hear about is, you know, what did the union think about your case and how you know, and what was their advice to you?
The California Supreme Court said in a parallel case that it would be ridiculous to assume that the system set up by the legislature meant that the only advice the union advocate could give to his client was, don't talk to me.
Right.
But that's the situation we have now. Since the ruling in this case below, right now, every union member in the state cannot be assured that what he says to his union, is confidential.
I mean, it seems to me that if what the state needs to know, did you or did you not exhaust your remedies, there should be some form that the, you know, that the employee and the union rep can sign attesting to that, yes or no.
Form or some very basic questions.
Right. If there's a dispute, you can have it. You can have it.
We did here.
Right.
Yeah.
But it just seems, you know, yeah, I'm sensitive to the issue.
Now, one of the questions that has come up is why should the legislature address this now when the Supreme Court has it on its plate? And there are two answers to that. One is that right now, no union communications in the state are confidential, and they won't be until either the Supreme Court rules or the legislature enacts a bill like this. And who knows how long it'll take the Supreme Court to rule. They are not very fast. So there is a need right now to do something. The other reason is the Supreme Court is doing something different from what you are. In the Supreme Court, the issue is whether it is unconstitutional as a violation of due process to allow the state to make this kind of demand from the union and from the union member. That constitutional bar, the due process one, is very high, very difficult to meet, whereas you are in the position of saying, is this fair? Is it good policy that we prohibit this and level the playing field? Supreme Court isn't going to make its decision on that kind of consideration. Therefore, it makes sense for you to go ahead and make your own judgment call here on whether this is a good idea or we should.
And Mr. Chairman, I agree with that. And I was trying to think, you know, when is it tactical information and when does it have a huge impact on the company? For example, a union may use that to pressure a company to do something that it might otherwise not economically have figured in. So this one case kind of brings us to light. Has there been other places where this came to light, where we had a communication between a union employee and a rep and a company or the state where there was a subpoena that said, we want to know what you guys were talking about?
I don't think it's happened here, because this has just started within the last couple of years. Earlier, when I was doing these things for the state, we wouldn't even have thought of this. But in other states, California, New York, Tennessee, New Jersey, New Hampshire, Washington, Illinois, have all said, you cannot do this. The NLRB, the Federal Labor Relations Board, have all said, you cannot do this. So, statutorily, it's been enacted in two states. In fact, I think this bill is largely lifted from the Illinois state.
That's what I was going to ask. This tries to drive a line down through what is and isn't going to be available for information.
Yes, and it also has an escape clause saying that if the plaintiff, with us, the state, really does need certain information, can't get it elsewhere, you can go to the judge and request it, and then the judge will make a judgment call as to which interest is more important.
We do have several other people lined to testify. Mr. Mertz, thank you. Unless you have a closing remark you'd like to make.
No, sir.
Let's turn to Kate Sheehan. Have her come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name's Kate Sheehan. I'm Deputy Director of Labor Relations for the Department of Administration. I'm here today to talk about Section 2 of the bill, which would amend Section 234065 of the Alaska Statutes. And specifically under that section, it talks about proceedings that would include arbitrations, hearings, or meetings that are part of the grievance procedure conducted under the authority of collective bargaining agreements. This proposed legislation would turn the grievance process into a legal process found only in the courts. It is to the betterment of both parties to have a grievance process that is self-governing and bargained. Both parties have bargained specific grievance processes into their collective bargaining agreements, and both parties are bound to follow the process. The union representatives work with Division of Personnel and Labor Relations representatives, and there are no attorneys involved. And I just want to clarify what Mr. Owens had discussed in the opening. It is true that I do have attorneys on my staff. However, they are not engaged in the practice of law. They are not required to be licensed, and some are not. They are considered labor relations analysts. Therefore, there is
They've
no
got a legal
attorney
training,
privilege.
Legal background, but they're not practicing attorneys
exactly.
For all intents and purposes.
Okay. In a previous hearing on this bill, a question was raised as to fairness. Is it fair that the state could subpoena the communications of the union, but the union could not do the same of the state? I don't believe fairness is an issue with regards to Section 2 because there is no subpoena authority found in the state's collective bargaining agreements. The Uniform Arbitration Act has not been adopted in our agreements, as is required by Alaska Statute 94310.
Say that again. I don't understand what that is.
So the Uniform Arbitration Act, it's found in Title 9 of the statutes, allows for subpoena in arbitrations. However, there's also a section that says it must be expressly adopted in collective bargaining agreements.
All right, thank you.
And the state has not done this, except for one exception with the Public Safety Employees Association, where they do have the arbitrator can subpoena non-state employees to appear. That's the only way it's been adopted.
But, for example, if I was that hardware company that had people, I could actually agree to that. If outside the state hasn't agreed to it, but it's something that somebody could agree to.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, yes. This means that the state cannot subpoena communications between the union representative and the employee during the grievance process. In addition, even if the state could, this does not happen in practice. Since I've been deputy director, I cannot recall one time that the state tried to subpoena union member communications. Further, with regards to fairness, at any point in the grievance process, either party could argue to the arbitrator that the other party was being unfair or not handing over documents that would be necessary to present their case. It would then be up to an arbitrator to determine if the documents requested were relevant to the proceedings at hand. Steps have been built into the grievance process for each side to make these type of arguments. This legislation would undermine what the parties have already agreed to through bargaining.
Hold it, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
So this law drills down into what you've already bargained. I thought this was going to be outside of that if they have gone through the grievance process and then choose to go to court. Or does this drill down into bargaining things already underway?
I'm going to guess we'll get a competing view from another witness.
Through the chair, I feel like in there's two sections here. Section 1 deals with the Code of Civil Procedure, which I think more is where this current case currently is. Mm-hmm. Section 2 talks about the arbitration process that has, of course, a grievance is filed. Before there's even a grievance filed in a discipline case, there's a predetermination meeting. A grievance may or may not be filed. There's steps through the grievance that could result in binding arbitration. My read of this in Section 2 is that the confidentiality would apply at that piece of it. However, during that grievance process, there is no subpoena authority, and the state would not have the ability to try to subpoena confidential communications.
Senator Wilikowski.
And I just want to point out, this is not only applying to this law. Does not only apply to state employees, public employees, it potentially is going to apply to all employees in the state, is my understanding. And I don't see how this undermines bargaining. If PARA has already ruled, and the National Labor Relations, if the NLRB and the ALRB have already ruled that this is privileged information, you can't get this information, how does it undermine collective bargaining?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we have language bargained into agreements about what union stewards and or board members can and can't do. There is one particular union that has, in fact, bargained specific language with regards to this. My understanding when I read PARA is that the idea is to have the unions and the employer work together to come up with an agreement on the wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment, which just would fall under terms and conditions of employment.
So you want the ability, so an employee who you said, no, typically attorneys aren't involved, so an employee is using someone who's not an attorney, and you want to be able to go in and get the tactics, the strategy, any information, confidential communications between the employee and his representative, you want as a state to be able to go in and get that information.
Well, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'm only here to discuss
Is that a yes or a no?
I'm here to discuss Section 2.
Well, that's what you're saying you want in Section 2. You want the ability to go and get any tactical information, strategic information, settlement information that an employee has with his representative. That's what you're saying you want.
Through
Is that true? Yes
Senator
or no?
Wilikowski, no, not at all. In fact, we don't have that ability now. The unions would have to give us that ability, and I, at this point, there's been no push to bargain the Uniform Arbitration Act subpoena.
Mr. Chair, in all fairness, you're taking a view that's solely within the grievance process. You're not speaking about the court process.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, and actually, that's what I was going to ask. If it goes into the court, do the rules change
dramatically?
Yeah, and that's. You know, I don't have the benefit of having the knowledge.
Yeah, no, I'm moving not much faster than you are, Senator Coghill. I don't do this as a part of my practice.
All I'll say is we're going to hear from other employees, and I think this is an incorrect interpretation. I think.
Well, let's do this. Let's have Ms. Sheehan finish her statement, and then we will get another rebuttal witness in, and then we'll call it a day.
Okay, I'll try to just hit on one other part.
Sure.
That I feel is fairly important.
Sure.
I believe this legislation also presents problems for agencies, particularly those that provide security-related services. And I'd like to share with you an actual case that came out of the Department of Corrections. There's a correctional officer who reported to her shift supervisor that she was aware of potential unethical actions within the correctional institution. The shift supervisor, who also happened to be a union board member, failed to immediately report this information as is required by department policy. The subordinate officer allegedly told him that she was telling him this information in confidence as her union representative. She later claimed to management that she had never told him that. However, our concern here is that a shift supervisor learned information that could pose a security risk, and he failed to timely alert management because he felt he was being told this information in his role as a union representative. Therein lies the problem. Management can only act upon information they receive, which is why it is vital to certain agencies, such as corrections, the Departments of Public Safety, Military Veterans Affairs, and Health and Social Services, that staff report security, neglect, or similar issues. An employee could use this legislation to hide behind rather than taking the appropriate measures of reporting security issues and other matters required by policies and procedures to be reported up the chain of command. At the same time, the employee union representative, which I explained before is also known as a steward or board member, could hide behind this legislation to avoid a potential disciplinary matter for themselves for failure to report the issue as required. This places management in a very difficult position. And I will end my statement at that point, because I know you'd like to hear from other people, but I am available for questions.
Thank you. And this answered my question on the difference between kind of a strategy. How do you advise your employee, if you're a union steward, to engage a process over against how does it impact the actual duties required in that job? And that's I heard at least that much.
It's a fair concern. I think there has to be some sort of marker that goes up at some point that say, okay, we've begun a disciplinary process. And now when you have conversations within the context of this disciplinary process between you and your union rep, those are confidential. But you know, whether or not to disclose something about an unsafe practice at a prison strikes me that we can define our way around it. But I appreciate that. That's a good example. Thank you so much for being here, Ms. Sheehan. Let's turn to Stephen Sorensen from the PSCA. Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record, and you probably got 3 to 5 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Steve Sorensen. I'm a local attorney here in town, and I also represent the Public Safety Employees Association. We think that this legislation is important, and let me just tell you the experience that we have as a union. In January, or actually later in 2011, we received a subpoena for the union's records from attorneys representing the city of Fairbanks, who were representing two members who were members of the Fairbanks Police Department, who were under contract with PSCA in the city of Fairbanks. One member had been terminated, the other member had been demoted and had received a suspension. They were suing the city civilly, and were represented by counsel, and the city was represented by outside counsel as well. So they sought the union records and wanted to know what was the advice and strategies that we had supplied to those members when we were representing them under the collective bargain agreement. Both of these members had gone through the entire grievance procedure. Both of these members had gone through arbitration, And these were, so this, the whole administrative procedures that were found in the collective bargain agreement had been satisfied. And now they are in the process of suing the city of Fairbanks. And now we have attorneys, not the state, but civil attorneys, who are seeking the union's records with regard to the advice and strategies that we gave to these members during the time of our advocacy, our business agents' advocacy representation. And they even then proceeded to take the deposition of the former executive director of the union, and specifically under in a deposition format, asked him exactly, you know, what was the advice that you gave these members, and what was the strategy used by the union in its representation. Now, in each of those instances, we responded to the subpoena and provided them with limited discovery and a list of privileged documents that we were not going to supply. And so far, the city's attorneys have not pressed that issue. And in the deposition, the former executive director indicated that he would not provide the city's attorneys with that information unless he was so ordered by a court to do so. And they have not, you know, pressed that issue. But it seems to me that it won't take much of an effort with this case now having been argued before the Supreme Court about this issue, and this understanding amongst union members and employers of that employ union members, that the relationship between an advocate, a union advocate, and the union member and employee is not a privileged relationship during the disciplinary proceedings, that we could very well anticipate a further push by the attorneys who represent the city of Fairbanks for more information and require us to disclose that information.
Senator Coghill.
So I take it was not, these two were not pleased with the binding arbitration settlement.
Well, I mean, we, you know, a union has an obligation under its duty of fair representation to review and take up, you know, properly presented grievances all the way through the administrative procedures set out in the collective bargain agreement. But the duty of fair representation, you know, stops as to the to whether or not an arbitration is required. That is a decision that lies solely with the union and not with the grievant. And so we have a contractual obligation, and we have a legal obligation to represent the member all the way up through arbitration.
They have a choice not to go to that.
And they can and the union can decide, you know, for whatever reasons that the arbitration should not go forward, and the grievant, the employee, then has the right to take whatever civil action they wish to take. Or the union can decide that we'll take it all the way through the grievance process, which is our duty under the duty of fair representation, and then we take it to arbitration because we think it's an important issue that needs to be arbitrated and decide, because it's either the issue with regard to a termination or contract interpretation. But even at that point in time, as the example that I provided, those two employees, having gone through arbitration, are still civilly suing the city of Fairbanks.
I understand that. I just wanted to know if they lived under the arbitration and then chose to go outside of that decision.
Yeah, I think any employee is entitled to take whatever action they wish to take after they have gone through the grievance procedure under a collective bargain agreement. And if they are satisfied with that or dissatisfied with that, they're free to take whatever action.
Mr. Chairman, and all I'm trying to get in my head is that is a kind of a bargained and protected unit. And once you go out into civil court, the rules change. And so then discovery should change.
Well, the rules change, Senator Cock, through the chair of the Senator Cock. The rules change, but still, the conversation that the union rep had with the member with regard to that representation during that period of advocacy under the contract should still be protected. And that's what this legislation does. It ensures that conversation, those strategies, those theories and thoughts and processes that went on are still remain in a confidential and privileged state, and despite efforts by the employee afterwards or the employer afterwards to get to those to get to that information, that information should still be protected, and that's what this legislation does.
And I'm listening to this. I'm trying to figure out, when does a strategy advice compete with the policy and procedure advice that would determine the competency, issue? So that's what I'm trying to get at.
I guess my and I'll let you wrap up with a clear remark. My belief, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, is there should be some way to solve the technical issue of whether or not, letting a court know whether or not the procedural steps of exhaustion of remedies has taken place.
Well, through the chair here,
that shouldn't be a secret.
Well, no, it's not a secret, right? Because the employer and the employee and the union are in lockstep through all the steps of the grievance procedure. And so the employer knows whether or not all the grievance steps have been satisfied and whether the matter has gone to arbitration or not gone to arbitration. And the union knows that, and the employee knows that. There's no secret to that information. I mean, what the state has argued today is that that information as to the strategy of that advocacy and why the union and the employee did not take it to arbitration, or even if they did take it to arbitration, why it's going on to civil, that conversation should be protected and should not be able to be disclosed under any other proceeding.
If you don't take it to arbitration, have you exhausted your remedies?
Because under the duty of fair representation, the decision to take any grievance to arbitration lies with the union. That decision lies solely with the union, and the union is the one who decides whether or not the matter should be taken to arbitration.
If the union decides to not go to arbitration, can the employee go to court?
Yes, the employee can go to court.
So going to arbitration is not part of the exhaustion of remedies sequence?
Every collective bargaining agreement that the Public Safety Employees Association has arbitration as the final step, and it's final and binding.
Mr. Chairman, all I want to know is that a contractual obligation?
That is a contractual obligation, and it also exists in para.
Right. And see, that to me is one of the real issues. They've agreed to do that, and when there's a breach of that, then I would think that not fulfilling that complete contractual obligation, going outside of that, could really be the question.
Well, I need more. I'm just going to close and say I need more education on the subject, and we can't do it right now because we've all got other matters to be attending.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you all for attending a very informative hearing. With that, we're going to go ahead and adjourn.